date is the 31st July 2015. I'm in 32 Lincoln's Inn with Richard Layard. Richard, please can you state your full name and your date of birth, please?
Peter Richard Grenville Layard, born 15th of March 1934. Well, I first came to LSE as a graduate student, part-time graduate student in sociology. I had done a history degree at Cambridge, and I was teaching in a history in a comprehensive school, and I wanted to broaden my education. And I enrolled for an MSc in sociology. So I had some wonderful tutorials with Donald McRae, and I went to David Glass's seminar, but I also went to some classes in survey methods given by Klaus Moser. And about that time, the Robbins Committee on Higher Education was being set up. And Klaus was appointed as the statistical advisor to the commission. And either he or Anne Boehm, neither of them can remember, thought I would be good to be the research officer. And so I was asked to be the research officer. So I abandoned, actually, as it turned out, forever, my planned career in secondary school teaching, and sort of headed towards academia. But I didn't know that at the time. But I worked for the Robbins Committee for 3 years, and we produced 5 or 6 volumes of research. And during that period, Klaus and Robbins concocted the idea of a research unit on higher education at LSE, of which Klaus would be the director and I would be the deputy director. So that's how I then came to LSE. I never finished my MSc in sociology, but I had an awful first 2 weeks at LSE, where I had come thinking I probably knew more about higher education than anybody else in the world. And I discovered, and well, somebody said, what's your theoretical framework? And I, of course, realized that I had no clear discipline for answering questions like those which had come up at the Robbins Committee, such as a paper from the Treasury saying, why should we expand higher education rather than rebuild the decaying cities of the north of England? I had begun to realise that I would have to become an economist. So, having been appointed here, I had, in a way, the great good fortune of being able to be a student on full pay. And I did the MSc in a couple of years while I was also helping Klaus run that centre, and I was doing a bit of work on educational development in India at the time. And then a couple of years after that, I joined the economics department as a lecturer. And I just enjoyed teaching enormously. And for about 10 years, I think I was probably enjoying teaching and spending a lot more time teaching than researching. But what happened was that the centre that we had founded, as originally as a higher education research centre, it then broadened out, and Klaus left to be head of the government statistical office. So it broadened out with me in charge into being a centre in the economics of education, and then in labour economics, and then eventually it transformed itself into something called the Centre for Economic Performance in 1990, but the centre has been there since 1964. On the whole, growing all the time, and I think becoming better and better. I handed it over to John Van Rienen in 2003, and I think it's become even better since then. So I've always had a base in a research centre. But in that early period, as I said, I did a lot of teaching. I wrote a textbook with Alan Walters. But I think that my research really took off here when unemployment went up in 1979. And this was a huge challenge. Nobody knew how to think about it, what on earth was going on. There was stagflation. There was inflation in the presence of high unemployment. And I was incredibly lucky that we had already in the centre two wonderful colleagues, Steve and Nicol, who brought really tremendous technical power as well as enormous common sense, and Richard Jackman, who's incredibly insightful. And the three of us worked together really for 10 years on unemployment. The centre was probably at that time the world's leading centre for the study of unemployment. Chris Bisserid was there and had already been doing very powerful theoretical work on this, and he joined in on the empirical side also. And there were others. And we had a weekly seminar, and we had five international conferences in the 1980s. And we produced, I think some people called it the Layard-Nicol model, a model for thinking about unemployment, which became, I think it's fair to say, the standard way in which European economists thought about unemployment and the factors affecting the lowest level of unemployment you could have without inflation taking off. So we were focusing, as a result of our empirical studies, on two things, how wages were formed and also how unemployed people were treated. And that work on how unemployed people were treated really led to the idea that unconditional unemployment benefits and letting people disappear from sight led to them disappearing as effective members of the labour force. It was not a good way to treat people, either from the point of view of the people or the taxpayer. And instead, you need more conditionality for benefits, but also more active help to people to help them to become employable and find the right job. And this became known as the welfare-to-work approach. We were actually very influenced by Scandinavia and then influenced them. But I think the actual word came from the States, but with a rather different intellectual history. So that was a great period. I think that was one of the best periods in the history of our centre in the 1980s. That work on unemployment. The next big change that happened in the world, of course, was the transition from communism to capitalism in Eastern Europe. And I spent quite a lot of time in Russia. That was very, very interesting. We had we produced a monthly publication and had a monthly press conference where I held forth to 60 journalists, Russian and foreign, about what was going on in Russia and what the implications of different policies would be. And that was very, very interesting. But it didn't lead to a sort of ongoing research program, really, after the first 8 or 9 years of the transition, that faded away. And I thought that the time had come to address what I had experienced, actually, when I first came into economics, which was the extraordinarily limited assumptions which economists have about what makes people happy. And I had been attracted to economics because it purported to be a way of thinking about how we can balance the different priorities in a way that would be best for human happiness. But the actual theory of psychology that was being used didn't turn out to be very very right. And I had thought about doing something about this. I wrote an article in 1980 in the Economic Journal about it. but there wasn't then much empirical knowledge on happiness, and I discovered toward the end of the 90s that there had been this huge amount of work by psychologists on what actually determines human happiness, and I thought the time had come for me to write about that. So that has been what I've been doing in one way or another ever since. With more help from outside LSE than from inside LSE, to be honest. I mean, I'd just like to say before I go on to that I have found LSE just an utterly wonderful environment. First, in allowing me to do whatever took my fancy, provided I could raise the money to finance it, which I was always able to do through this centre. But second, just incredibly helpful. So when I was writing my textbook on microeconomics, just people were so helpful in reading chapters, instructing me in bits of economic theory I hadn't understood or studied. And I mean, I've always thought that it's incredibly important that an institution is happy, and that our centre, when I was running it, as I did for many decades, should be a happy place. Partly because what's the point of life without it? Partly actually because people can't get on with their work very well unless they're happy. So I the economics department never had any factions in it when I was a member of it, and I was a convener for 3 years. I can't imagine a better environment. But going back to my story about happiness, I decided I wanted to write a book about it. And I rang up Andrew Oswald. Now, Andrew had been a student, he'd been a student at Oxford, but a staff member in our centre for very many years. I had encouraged him to work on happiness, so he knew a lot about it by the time I asked him this question. How do I write a book on happiness? And he said, well, you ask Daniel Kahneman. So I asked Daniel Kahneman, and he said, I've got a perfect set of essays for you to read, and then you can come over and see me at Princeton, which I did twice. And I have, in general, been the person who's been the moving spirit in selecting the people to give the Lionel Robbins Memorial Lectures. I thought, why can't I give one of them? I thought it'd be a good way to help me develop my ideas. So I handed over the job for a year to somebody else who got me invited to do that. So I gave these lectures, and then I wrote the book. And it was published in the end in about 20 languages and so on. It's been a small part of this extraordinary huge worldwide movement, which you might call Beyond GDP, or has many different names, but the well-being movement, the movement which says that we should judge the state of our societies by how happy people are, and in particular how few people are miserable. I think that struck a chord, and it, coming from an economist, it had an extra force, because it was perhaps rather surprising to people to have an economist saying this sort of thing. So I published a book in 2005, and then by which time I'd handed over the running of a centre for economic performance to John Byrne Renan, but he very nicely allowed me to set up a little small programme within the centre on well-being, because of course if you want to promote the well-being of the people, you've got to understand what determines it. So we've had an ongoing research program there, which has been very much involved with using one of the things in which Britain is very strong, which is a whole series of birth cohort studies where people are followed throughout their lives, and you can see what is determining how their well-being evolves, and that's been a very satisfying experience with some great colleagues there. And then, of course, I having published a book, I thought, well, what can one most do in practical terms to improve the well-being of, let's say, the British population? And the area which had been so shockingly neglected was mental health. So I fortunately met up with a wonderful, one of the world's leading clinical psychologists, David Clark, who was at the Institute of Psychiatry in London. And we proposed to the government a new program to make evidence-based psychological therapy properly available within the National Health Service. And I formed a Centre for Economic Performance policy group, which sort of added weight to what we were proposing in a bit more detail, and we worked out how this should be done. And fortunately, it was accepted by the government in 2007, and it's happened. A hugely important development, of course, imperfect in many ways, but still going forward. So that was another outside link. So I think my links have been more outside LSE in the last 15 years than they were in the previous period. That has been a good experience, and I've now actually got involved in trying to promote a much better approach to the problem of global warming, which is to have it treated like a wartime problem of survival, where you get the best scientists together and you find you give them enough money to solve a problem. The problem being, of course, to produce clean energy that's cheaper than dirty energy. And hopefully, this is 2015, and we're recording this, hopefully this will have led to a number of the world's main countries joining this program by the end of this year. That's, I hope, it's called at the moment it's called the Global Apollo Program. So it's structured with a 10-year time frame and a clear objective to make renewable energy cheaper than coal-based energy within a 10-year period. So that's again involved me with working with scientists and, of course, with Nick Stern, who's played such a role in the climate change history. But I suppose the other things which I have done, there are two other quite interesting, I think, things that I've done based on my view that maybe it's old-fashioned, but certainly we had this view very much in the 80s, that if you want to do something which you might call an activist, if you want to have an activist movement that involves people outside LSE, you probably shouldn't do it from within academia. You should probably do it outside of academia. So to get our welfare to work proposals accepted, in the mid-1980s we formed something called the Employment Institute, which did a very good job over 15 years until basically those principles were established and accepted in Britain and in many European countries, of course Germany and the Hartz reforms being the most striking case. And then more recently, to get this well-being idea more widely accepted and people more aware of the power of positive psychology to improve their own lives and the lives of the society, we formed something called Action for Happiness. But fortunately, the school has always been a wonderful, tolerant place, so it's kind of understood that you can do this from your base in the school, but we definitely thought that the formal base should be outside the school, and that's how we've we've done that, but nothing in my professional life would have been possible without the school. And I think it's just amazing that you should be able to follow your thoughts about, you know, what needs to be researched, what needs to be changed in the world, without changing your job. You just sit here and you try and introduce whatever you think is needed for improving the human lot. And I like to think that that's what the Webbs and the Shaws and others thought the school was going to be about, that you would have high intellectual standards and rigour and honesty in your research work, but that you would have another part of your activity would be actually getting the message across outside and actually even prodding people to do the things which your research showed to be necessary. So I think LSE is quite a model, actually, of how rationality can be used to understand the world and to change the world.
Is changing the world one of the things that you think entices students to come and study here?
I don't know why students come and study here. I mean, it depresses me to some extent. I think a lot of them come and study here simply in order to gain access to a well-paid job in the city. And I think some of the activities of the financial sector are incredibly important and incredibly necessary, but some of them are not. And I feel a bit sad when people that we've educated end up going and spending a lot of energy in a zero-sum casino, but that's a small point. I had a very nice experience. I was invited to a dinner in New York for some alumni and friends last year. And John Williams, who had been a student, I taught the master's degree in labour economics for 20 years or so, had been one of the students. And he is now the president of the Federal Reserve Board in San Francisco. And the dinner was in New York. And he flew across all that way just to this dinner and flew straight back. Which I found very touching. But he said to me something which I had completely forgot, which was that when the students were choosing their option, so when you did the MSc, there were three pretty compulsory papers and an option at that time. When they were choosing their option, there was a sort of hustings, and different teachers would give talks about their options. And I said that I thought that when the student was choosing an option, one of the criteria, the best criteria would be, is this option going to help me to do something to improve the world? And he said it was such an extraordinary idea, never been suggested to him in his previous undergraduate economics degree, that you might study economics in order to improve the world. So I do think that is a reason why some people come here, and I hope it'll be more and more. And certainly it is a spirit which some people catch here and want to do something about when they leave. I think, of course, one extraordinary thing about the school is simply the number of interesting people who come and give talks. I mean, it's overwhelming, of course. You just can't go to them all, but I think that is another feature that attracts people to LSE. I'm quite sure being in theatre land and all sorts of other things also attracts them.
You mentioned that you were a convener at the economics department for a few years. Were you involved in any other sort of administrative or academic boards or positions
No, I thought one should be a good citizen, and I always thought I was being a good citizen by running the Centre for Economic Performance, you know, which housed something like, I don't know what, 30 PhD students, and provided a framework for another 60 or so people to do their research, either while holding a teaching post at LSE or outside. So I thought that was one thing I was doing, which was you know my bit for the institution, and the other was being convener. So I never ever participated in LSE administration or politics. Well, from 1980, it was based on in the top of the library building, top of the Lionel Robbins building, with Stickard. I mean, there have always been two big research centres in economics, which have been sitting together up there.
And how do you find working and doing research in the centre of London, like the position here of LSE?
Well, I think the position is amazing. From a professional point of view, because it's so the access to Whitehall, which has been important to me, is so fantastic. But so, of course, is access to the city and to the law courts, and this is what has helped to hold this exceptionally talented staff together. In a place which is, in other ways, in many ways, you know, quite difficult to get to compared with living more on campus at Oxbridge or somewhere else, and also, you know, more difficult place to bring up children and so on. Well, I would imagine the future will look have a lot of continuity with the past, but I think actually there is a problem which we haven't really found a solution to, that is, if you move into an interdisciplinary area like wellbeing, which is in between psychology and economics, there is not a very straightforward career path for you at LSE. In fact, LSE has not been as good as many top American universities in its broad-mindedness towards interdisciplinary research, in the sense that to get to be a professor in a major LSE department, if you don't mainly publish within the leading journals of your profession, it's not easy, and I think this is a problem that will have to be addressed. So I don't have any straightforward institutional solution. I love the economics department. I mean, I have a great emotional attachment to it, and I would love to see it more broad-minded over this. But we've not succeeded in getting the department to take on board at the senior level, anyway, you know, people with outstanding interdisciplinary reputations.
So departments are quite siloed, is what you're saying.
Yes, I mean, you know, one obvious thing is that. Whereas in America, economic history is in the economics departments. At LSE, it's not. there's even at that rather more traditional level, a not particularly desirable division, I think.
While working here, can you tell me a little bit about how you felt about your colleagues? Was it an intellectually stimulating environment to work with people that you worked with? Have you made friends? Would you still keep in contact with people you met here?
Yes, I mean, obviously, it's been an incredibly collaborative place. But I think, I mean, one of the great things, obviously, is the seminar life at LSE, which is probably unrivaled in British universities. And what, in particular, I think we tried to create in the centre was a seminar where you just didn't have one paper after another, you know, who can we have next? And we didn't think of the subject as one paper after another. We strongly discouraged people from writing one paper after another rather than to take a big question and really try and sort it out. So, I mean, we had this seminar, as I say, it was a weekly seminar. It was all relevant in one way or another to unemployment for over a 10-year period. And we had these five conferences. And I think that this is a much better way of organising academia than to say, well, who's got another interesting paper to give? That's not, in a way, that's not a completely serious approach to knowledge.
Have you found the way people do research at LSE has changed since you started here?
Well, it's totally changed, of course, because the first great breakthrough was when you could go to the University of London Computer Centre in the evening and put in your specified regressions, hopefully with every comma in the right place. And with luck, when you came back the next morning, the regression would have been run. If a comma hadn't been in the right place, you'd be doing it again the following evening.
Is this the cards?
No. SPSS.
Yeah.
So that's talking about the 70s, mid-70s or so. The PC obviously changed that enormously, getting away from mainframes. But, I mean, the whole of the knowledge world is completely different, isn't it? I mean, you hardly ever see anybody looking at a book in the library, or never going to a book on the shelves of the library. So it's all on the computer. The access to the sort of information, world's information base is almost instantaneous, so we don't waste time sort of checking up on things. It doesn't mean at all that we're necessarily going to do hugely better, because how well we do depends on how well we can think and structure the questions with which we address the data. But getting the data together, including numerical data and information, it's just so much easier, and the rate at which people write papers has, of course, become quite extraordinary. The problem is how to make sure that they all add up to something, because, you know, one damn paper after another, it's not so easy to integrate it. And I'm not a great fan, you know, of meta-analyses and review articles and so on, but we need as research groups to find ways of producing sort of answers to the big picture questions.
What have the main challenges been while you've been here? The biggest difficulties, do you think?
I don't think that there have been any big institutional difficulties which could easily have, that I'm aware of, that could easily have been been overcome. I mean, I didn't have a good mathematical education when I was young, so I would love to personally been more fluent in math. I suppose that if you're asking what limits I personally experienced, that would be the main one. I think what is extraordinary about LSE is that if you've got a question about almost any aspect of society, there's almost certainly somebody here who can tell you something about it, and that's just wonderful. And I mean, the other thing I found really good was that, and the way we created our centre was we had enough money to give these underpaid academics a little bit of extra money for coming and working on really important questions. And so we were able to attract into the centre people to work on empirical questions of importance and reach some sort of a critical mass by basically having a little bit of money to encourage them to do what in some sense is more time consuming, particularly it was then. I mean, to do empirical work then was really hard work compared with doing theory in terms of how long it would take you to write an article. So I think we were incredibly lucky that we got together this remarkable group of people, which has had a shifting membership, but the centre has still got outstanding people in it, as it has had for 40 years or so.
So you've kind of answered quite a few of the questions I was going to ask you already.
Right. Good.
is there anything that you want to talk about that you feel that we haven't covered or that I haven't asked you about?
I don't think so. I mean, I think another important thing I would like to say is that I think the school has been remarkable in that it has embraced people from a whole range of political perspectives within a completely colleagly framework. Oh, that's certainly true in economics. I wouldn't want to say about some departments where I think there has been felt to be a bit more of an orthodoxy at times that people who didn't share it felt uncomfortable. But I mean, I developed one of my strongest supporters in the department, because it always helps when you're a lecturer to have some professor who takes an interest in you, was Alan Walters, who became advisor to Margaret Thatcher. And we had a totally different, totally different view of the importance of equality and therefore different politics. But he was incredibly nice and helpful to me, and that was just what happened in the department, and there were people far to the left of me as well.